day, eh?
Good day.
Good day, eh? And welcome to another Forge Side Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between with a heavy focus on talent in the Great White North.
You're talking about Canada, eh? And today on the show, we've got a gentleman out of the Halifax area. We've got Peter LePage. Did I say that right, Peter?
LePage.
LePage. There we go. My bad.
Yeah, LePage Day. Yeah.
LePage Day. So Peter's been at this for about 20 years now. You can go check him out on the good old Instagram under Peter LePage. And he's making tongs and hammers and all sorts of stuff kind of designed towards knife making. He's also making blacksmithing tools like hot cuts and chisels and stuff like that designed for blacksmithing more or less in general. He's also making knives himself, some really awesome stuff. Go check out his stuff that they're on Instagram, like his thing. And one of the beautiful things about this whole ensemble that we've got going on right now is Peter's a supplier for Maritime Knife Supply, and Maritime Knife Supply just happens to sponsor Forgeside Chat. You can go check out Maritime Knife Supply at maritimeknifesupply.ca, and you can use the code FSCKILN at checkout to save yourself $100 on Paragon and even heat kilns. You can also save yourself 10% on grinding belts if you buy 10 pack, and you'll save yourself 10%. So
getting the sponsor reads out of the way early.
Yeah, well, you know what? Maritime's been good to us, so let's do it.
Lawrence has been great for the community as a whole. He's really stepped things up for everybody here. Yeah, yeah. You got to appreciate it.
Yeah. So, Nick, how's your week been going?
It's been a bit of an up and down week, but I've been trying to get a little bit of work done here and there. I made myself a belt buckle for a belt. First time I've ever done that. And it was kind of a fun little project. But other than that, it's just kind of been a bit meh. How about yourself, Lando? Making anything cool?
I don't think we've chatted about this yet, but I made myself a pretty wicked, well, didn't make myself. I made it for the wife, Dragonfly. And
yes,
tell you what, man, I had a blast. That thing was fun to make. I really, really enjoyed making that thing, dude. It's was a little bit of experimentation going on in there, and it worked out so awesome. I don't know if I want to divulge exactly the secret that I found out or not, but I literally was almost able to paint copper onto the steel, dude. It was so cool.
Nice. Was that like a hot brush technique or?
It was a forge welding brushing technique.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
You basically forge brazed it.
Forge brazed it and brushed it with a wire brush at the same time while it was liquid hot. And I'll tell you what, dude. It was the fucking coolest thing I've ever seen to see that molten copper just sloshing around on top of the steel. Oh, fuck. That was so awesome.
Yeah, it actually does sound like a pretty cool thing. It's one of those ones where eventually I'm going to play around with that Kumai or Kumaskus stuff.
Yeah, that stuff is pretty awesome.
Yeah, because I've done forging copper and stuff like that, but I've never actually incorporated it into like layers and stuff. Maybe soon I'm going to give that a try. Oh, the one thing I forgot, I finally finished up that one chisel and posted it for sale.
Saw that. And?
Yeah. Wow, I mean, nobody's bid on it yet. Come on, listeners. Somebody wants to drop a ton of money on a chisel.
I'm surprised it hasn't gone yet. That's a piece of beauty, piece of art. Awesome.
Yeah, it did turn out really well. I'm pretty proud of that.
Is that something that, would you use it? Or is that just, like, I'd be scared to use something that's really nice, dude.
Well, I mean, it is designed to be usable if you want to use it. I would encourage somebody to actually use it. If you don't want to and you think it's too pretty, that's fine. But I mean, like, I spent a lot of time making sure it was like nice and razor sharp, and it's exactly 0.750 wide at the edge. All right, so it's actually going to work for all your needs. Like, I make sure that anything that goes out of my shop is a good functional tool. Sometimes it just happened to be really outrageously pretty.
Is this a wood chisel, Nick?
Hmm?
Is this a wood chisel you were making?
It is. Here, I've got it right here, and I'll show it to you.
Sorry, I haven't seen the post yet.
Get to see it right up. Actually, so they check it out on my Instagram.
They actually get to see it, dude.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So.
Oh, okay. Sweet.
All right. Copper inlay. Fake wood handle. The copper inlay. I'll gun glued fittings.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's slick, man.
Yeah, it turned out pretty nice. I'm pretty happy with it.
There'll be a nice woodworker who hangs that one on a wall in a shop somewhere.
Yeah, maybe. Like I said, it is very usable. So, you know, I hope they would get used every now and again for, like, those real special projects.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Oh, somebody's cracking a cold one here.
They are twist-offs. Son of a gun. No, it's not twisting off. No, it's not a twist-off. What the hell? It's not popping.
Doesn't matter. Just use the bottle opener. Crack it off of there.
I'm trying to use a fucking bottle. I'm using the wrong side here. That's what's going on. Duh.
Oh, my. What are we going to do with you?
I don't know. That's a good call. Good question. Yeah. Kind of been wondering that myself.
Well, happy Friday, boys. I'm going to crack one with you then.
Cheers.
There we go. Cheers.
Mmm. Mexican beers. Those are always good, hey?
I should go run and get one, too. Here, hold on.
All right. So what have you been up to this week, Peter?
Work's been busy. I'm a general contractor as well. So we were building a big deck this week. So that's scratched off the list now. Just finished up today. So nice to get that finished up for sure.
Cool, dude. Yeah. It's got to be a fun job at this time of year.
Yeah, when the weather starts to warm up, you can get outside and work again. But generally try to schedule indoor work for the winter time. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. What are you drinking, Nick?
I'm having a Mill Street Cobblestone Nitro Stout.
Holy smokes. There you go. Louise.
Bread in a can.
Yeah, pretty much. That's dinner.
What are you drinking?
I've got a local brew from Cape Breton, which is northern part of Nova Scotia here. It's called 7 Years by Breton Brewery. It's a good beer. Yeah.
Seven years?
That's what it's called, yeah.
Nice. Mm, cool. Yeah. I'm drinking a Sol.
Nice.
Sole. So, dude, you got into this, like you said, in your mid-20s, you were telling me. What kind of drove you to get into it?
It started with knife making for me. I've always spent time in the woods as a kid, you know, sort of, I think there's a term bushcraft now, but we just called it camping back in the day. you know, you go out with your buddies and spend a weekend in the woods just camping and hiking around. So in my 20s there, I saw a video on YouTube. It was Green Pete was the guy's name, and it was the most rudimentary knife making video, but it was a great introduction if you had no knowledge of heat treatment or steels. And basically he just showed you how to take a file and anneal it in a campfire overnight and in the coals and bury it in ashes, and then shape it with a grinder and a file and put a handle to it, and sort of set me on my way from there, and slowly, you know, it just grew from there. The love and the passion for the industry and the trade just got a hold of me, and that was the end of it. So, yeah.
Yeah, that must have been an early YouTube video.
Oh, it was. I don't even think the video is on there anymore. I mean, this guy lived in the woods in a cabin with no power, and he, you know, he's running off deep cycle batteries, you know, for his drill and his grinder. It was pretty impressive, but you know, it was sort of probably one of these doomsday prepper guys. I have no idea, but it was definitely a fun one to watch at the time. Yeah, YouTube's come so far.
Oh, it's no kidding. Like, YouTube has it's insane. Dude.
Oh, when I started, there was no knowledge online. You couldn't learn about forging Damascus or heat treatments or you know, it was just so basic. You had to order books online or order them in through your bookstore and research and trial and error. There's so much information out there now. You know,
for sure.
What took us 10 years in the early beginnings, guys are learning in a year or two now. you know.
So yeah, for sure.
So what are some of the YouTube channels that you gravitate towards?
Oh, geez. One I really like, I don't know if I can pronounce his name properly, but I think it's Bjorn Armand.
Oh, yeah.
It's T.
Torbjorn Amund.
Yeah, yeah. But I really like him.
He does some super clean work, right?
Like, he does. He really
I
does.
Love his videos, too, because he doesn't get all, like, in-your-face cinematic, trying to be some, like, Hollywood producer kind of crazy nut job. And it's just, like, chill. Almost feels like you're watching Bob Ross video in a way.
Well, there's something humble about his work, and it's not boastful in any way, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Something about, you know, just the quiet forging of it. Yeah.
Well, he always seems to add in like a little peacefulness video of some sort, right?
Gardening or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So right, you got into the knife making and kind of carried into that and decided to eventually start your own shop. I'm sure. Were you still, you know, at a point where you could have a shop in your early 20s or?
It was probably about 11 years ago that I really set up my first shop. I bought my house just outside of town here, and I've got a big 30 by 35 steel Kwanzaa hut.
Yeah, you got a sweet freaking shop, dude. No?
So I set that up, it was always just a hobby thing before that. But living in the city, you know, you fire up your coal forge in your backyard and start hammering. And wasn't it the exact same time that the little old lady next door would put out her white linens on the clothesline and you have to shut everything down, right? So, but when I moved out here and had the new shop, I set that up and it's just been growing since then. It was always a hobby craft until a few years ago. I incorporated the blacksmithing into the business, and then that's when I started producing more hammers and tongs and stuff like that for sale. Yeah.
You've had the contracting business and
so yeah, I'm a general contractor by trade. I'm a Red Seal carpenter. So I have my own general contracting business, just a small little company. But by incorporating the blacksmithing into the business, it's allowed me to work on rainy days or take a day every couple weeks and kind of get some hammers or tongs done up for orders. And I find it really peaceful and takes away the stress of everyday business. So, yeah, it's good that way.
I didn't realize that's what you were saying. That's really interesting, actually. So the blacksmithing and the general contracting are together under one hat?
Yeah, so using the business, I can sell with the HST number.
Nice. But so both businesses have to run under the same name or...?
I run them under the same name for tax purposes, with the HST number, but I just, LePay Knife and Tool is just my Instagram account, but right. It really falls under Redpoint Contracting. Yeah.
Okay. LePay Knife and Tool. That's your Instagram account. Shoot. I screwed that up at the beginning.
Oh, did you?
Sorry. I just,
you know,
I just
how well we prep for this show.
Yeah, well, it's just, in general, yeah. Welcome to me. Yeah. Oh man, my whole life's a mess. It's not just the podcast, don't worry. Actually, to be honest, I think the podcast is probably the thing that I'm most organized about, and that, what does that tell you?
Yikes, dude.
Yikes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Pete,
so what did you guys get up to this week?
Seal guy, you sound like you might be the kind of guy who needs a chisel.
Every time I try to have a good chisel on site, one of the guys gets hold of it, and next thing you know, it's been chiseling off a nail head or something. They always blame me for it, but read note.
Oh, come
truth.
On. If you have this one, you know nobody's going to use it to open a paint can.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah. I got a few tools in my shop. Some were gifts, some were bought. But there's always those tools where they're so beautiful, you just can't bring yourself to use them. And yeah, it's always a shame, but they're really nice keepsakes as well. But it also doesn't make sense owning something that you can't use. So,
That's why
I make them functional.
I have an issue with that because the dragonfly I just made.
Yeah.
Can't really use it.
Well, where does it go? Purpose that it fulfills.
The dragonfly is not a tool. It's art.
Yeah, but so you can't use it. So what good is it?
Well, you can run around with it in your hand like an airplane.
Look at it.
I don't know, man. It just eats me alive some days for some weird reason that art is just this thing that gets hung on a wall and eventually it has to really strike the right chord for it to last, you know, generations. That's for sure. Mm. A lot of it just goes straight to the trash, and that, you know, tools on the other hand, I mean, how many people have their grandpa's tools, right?
Yeah. I got some of my grandfather's hammers in my shop. And speaking of grandfathers, my primary anvil, it's an old Fisher 220, and it was my great grandfather's.
Oh, dude, that is so awesome.
And it's in immaculate condition. Yeah.
Oh, what? And it was your great grandfather's, dude?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Truly amazing. Gotta love
it. Yeah. So, right? Okay. I think this is a good time for us to, you know, maybe visit tell me about your tool.
I mean, tools.
Your dog didn't like that or what?
I don't know. He's whining over there, but I don't know how he can hear you through the headsets.
Yeah. I think it's pretty good hearing.
So you're saying you want to hear about my tool?
Tools.
Oh, okay.
Like to ask about the hammer. That's his favorite question. Tell us about your daily driver.
Hand hammers?
Yeah.
I've got a rack of them. The problem with making your own hammers is you have lots of them, because anytime there's one that's
always true, but you've always got one or two that are your first ones you pick up.
I've got about four that I probably go to primarily. I'm a real advocate for the rounding hammer. Not for any reason other than that's what I'm familiar with. That's where
it's a solid choice.
So, yeah. So I've got rounding hammers from 1.5 pounds up to 4.5 pounds. And those are my daily drivers. Now I do have, you know, some double diagonal cross peen or diagonal peens. I've got a couple ball peen hammers, some cross peens, Swedish cross peen styles, dog's head hammers. You know, I have hammers I like to use for different tasks, and that's kind of where I reach for there. But probably anywhere's in the 2.5 to 4 pound range is sort of my pickup daily driver, depending on what I'm forging at the time.
Right on.
Yeah.
What do you have for a rack? How are you organizing them?
Being a carpenter, it's a wooden rack. So it's a couple 2x8s for uprights, and then there's an angled shelf on the top with nails just dividing them up into sections, so I can just hook the hammerhead right over the top of the rack. And then in the rack itself, I've got a couple holes drilled through and just rebar run through to hang the tongs on below. And then shelf for all the punches and all the little jigs and pieces that you reach for. Yeah.
You have a picture of that on your Instagram? I didn't notice that.
No, it's not Instagram worthy, I don't think. It's
it's a noteworthy way to organize your tools. Most of us go with the poorly welded steel rack that's got like just the two bars and you stick the hammers down in between.
Right. Yeah. This is just function over form, you know, really more than anything. But it's
shop organization is one of those things that people really love to see how the different ideas, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a simple design, but given how the hammerheads just hang over the top and it's on an angle, you don't have to pull them out. You can just grab the handle and lift it up. Put the hammer you're using, you just set it down, grab the next one. So you can interchange really, really quickly. Sometimes you're going from a rounding hammer just to grab a cross peen really quickly and pull a lobe of a leaf out really fast and then put it back and go back to your rounding hammer. So it's all within arm's reach of the anvil. So, yeah. And then I keep a few tongs on the anvil on a little sidebar that are just there ready to grab for different purposes as well.
What do you have your anvil mounted to?
It's actually the original base that was on it when I got the anvil years ago. It's not a Fisher base. It's it was made. Yeah, I come from a long line of carpenters and masons, so it looks like old 2x4 cutoffs from way back in the day, stacked in a Jenga formation. So, and then they're all glued and nailed, and it works great. Yeah, so they don't pull out though. I've tried a few times, but I might change that out to a stump at some point here.
I don't pull out anymore either.
No.
Hey-o.
Good old married life.
So you're a knife guy. I suppose the next logical step would be, what are you using for a grinder?
I have a bead grinder, 2x72.
A bead grinder?
Yeah.
Like the green thing?
You got it, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Right on, bud.
Yeah. Yeah, so a number of years ago, I bought out another knife maker shop. He was moving back to Germany, and I got that in part of the parcel.
Cool, dude. That's,
yeah,
right on. And just the one grinder, eh?
Just the one grinder. I tend not to want to grind. It's not one of my least favorite things to do. So part of my process, if I'm making knives, is you can forge a knife to 70% completion and then you can just grind it and finish it off. I try to forge it closer to 95% and then,
what?
Yeah. And then
nearly forge to finish. There.
Wow. Yeah. I also do a few stock removal knives as well, but, forging is where the passion lies. Yeah. Not in the grinder. Yeah. For me, everyone's, got different talents and grinder is not my, my number one talent, I don't think. Yeah.
Hey, that's fair enough.
Yeah. The one obstacle with that grinder, I've considered upgrading to a different one, is I'd love to have a horizontal tilt attachment.
Mm.
That just opens up so many different doors. But I do have a couple different attachments for this with small wheels and flat platens and the 10-inch contact. And, all those attachments are nice. I'd probably have to purchase them again if I was to buy another grinder, and that starts to add up pretty quick. So until this one kicks the bucket, I'm just going to keep using it.
Yeah, there's ways you could repurpose stuff. I'm sure you could haul stuff off of old tool arms and put it on the new tool arms.
Well, I thought if I got a second grinder, I'd keep this one set up designated for one task, just for woodwork when you're making handles and stuff like that, rather than swapping back and forth between the grinders. You can
just keep things dedicated. Yep.
Yeah. I also don't like to, you got to be careful with wood sawdust, or on a grinder or in a blacksmith shop. So if you're doing a lot of handles in one day or one week for hammers, or axes or anything along those lines, you have to clean up that sawdust before you go to the next step.
Yeah. Got to do a little bit of shop vacuum before you, light the forge back up again and have your whole shop go kablooey.
That's right. Yeah. It's like the old, floor finishers, after they've done drum sanding the floors. If they lit a cigarette up, you'd see little sparklers going through the air, like little lightning bolts, and the fine particulate would just ignite.
You know, crazy? I don't know if you guys have noticed this with your forge. If you're grinding at all while your forge is lit, you can see sparklers coming out of your forge.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? No. I've never noticed, but I don't grind while the forge is on. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've been grinding. Like, I'll have been doing something quick with an angle grinder while the forge is lit, and you could definitely see it, especially because the way my shop's very tightly laid out. I'm infinitely jealous of all you people with giant shops.
That's the nice thing is you can space it out further, right? Keep the wood dust away from the
board. 13 by 13, and I got to fit a power hammer and a press there. But anyway, so where my vice is, oftentimes my sparks will fire over towards my forge. And yeah, you can totally see some interesting fireworks happening.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the old Japanese forges, or maybe they're Asian shops, but they would basically have like a hole in the ground, and they would stand inside this hole, and all their stuff would be in a circle around them, and they just turn 360 with the power hammer, their forge, their anvil, their tooling, and probably like a big water grinding stone on one side too.
And yeah, the Western version.
Yeah, that's
right. I don't like have everything sunk down into a pit, but yeah, I don't have to travel very far in my shop.
You don't have to climb over your anvil to get in your pit every morning.
No, I don't have to climb over the anvil to get into the pit. But it is it's very much that tight sort of everything. Yes. It's a very efficient movement.
I try
really hard to have my shop essentially set up the same way. Like I have a large shop, but the blacksmithing area is, I keep that circle, the trifecta, right?
I'm the same way. It's contracting equipment on one half, and then there's assembly tables and drill presses on the other half. And then the blacksmith shop is all crammed into probably a 15 by 15 area, really.
Nice.
With the power hammer, the press, the anvils, the forge. Yeah.
It's a dirt floor you have, right?
No, concrete.
Oh, how thick of concrete did you go?
I didn't build this shop. It was with the property when I bought it. So I'm not entirely sure. Yeah.
You're running a power hammer in there?
I am, yeah. But it's only a 50 pounder. It's an old Canadian Giant.
Beauty. Oh, cool.
Yeah, mechanical hammer. Yeah.
That's awesome. So, yeah.
It's funny, when I got the hammer, it was missing the center spring on the arms there. Oh, so I forged that myself and fit it in. And
what?
Yeah, yeah.
Why would you do that?
Why not?
Yeah, it's worked great, and I think I got it hitting a little harder than it should for a 50 pounder. It's working brilliantly. Yeah.
And so you know, you can get the parts for those from Little Giant down in the US, eh?
Yeah, but that's so much awesome. The whole point of having a mechanical hammer is that you can basically build any part of it if you've got the tenacity to want to do it.
Totally.
While this is true, the spring is one of the ones that I don't know that I'd mess around with.
Oh, well, I just grabbed an old coil spring off an old car I found in the woods and just forged it to the shape I wanted. And the diameter, and off to the races. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a Canadian Giant, and I had the spring actually go on it.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened to this one originally, I think.
Yeah. And I, of course, didn't have a guard on it. Now, luckily, I only just kind of got sprayed in the face with some metal dust. Everything just kind of went flop, but I was like, oh boy, better fix that.
Yeah.
I got a new spring, but I never put a guard on it.
Those mechanical hammers, I tell you, they're nerving when they get going full tilt. I don't know how many beats per minute it is, but it's over 100 beats per minute. The thing's just thumping away.
You got a spring guard?
I have a cage guard. It's not currently assembled on it right now, but the way this one... It's one of the earlier models, but I'm not familiar with all the terminology of all the parts of it, but the front section comes quite high. It actually covers most of the spring in the front, so it's guarded naturally on it. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your dog sounds very upset.
Yeah. Well, he thinks I'm just talking to the wall, right? He thinks his owner's lost the plot completely. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. For all those listening, we're wearing headphones. Sorry. Right. Yeah.
Easy. What got you into making? Well, okay. You know what? Maybe I shouldn't dive into that quite yet because we were talking about the tools, and I kind of want to keep on talking about the tools.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jumping ahead here. What kind of press do you got?
So I've got a Coal Iron Works press, 16 ton. Got that a number of years ago. Great little press. I debated with a couple different ideas, but with the Coal Iron Works, being an open, it's not an H style press. It allows me to come in from the side for doing axes and stuff like that. And that was really the biggest selling feature for me, was having an open end die that I could access from the side. Yeah. So
why,
I've got the.
Why do you say that?
For axes, it's great for drawing out the beard.
And but you're pulling drawing material dies? Sideways. You can leave the die in the drawing die. And
I just turn my material 90 degrees, and I don't have to change the dies out. I can just turn the material 90 degrees, and I can forge it.
It just means you're doing less. You're doing fewer tooling change ups.
Here's an axe, right?
Yep. Here we go.
If I'm forging out this, I draw the beard this way.
Yeah.
But then I can put it in this way, and I can draw it this way as well, in the same dies. It's a C die.
Yes.
Right. So it allows me to work more efficiently that way. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I set my home built press up as a C frame.
Yeah. The one problem with C frames is if you're like your oil bronze plates are a little loose or a little sloppy, you can get a little cant to it when it presses. And something I've started doing is using kiss blocks on the outside when I really need to square something up, because the inside is always going to be held by the frame. But to keep that open die on the end from squishing a little too hard down, just using kiss blocks at the top, trying to set. It helps keeps it square.
Hot tip right there, man, for sure. The C-frame, there you go. That's it, man.
First one's free. $4.99 for every tip going forward, right?
For everybody listening on Instagram, Peter LePay was just telling us that if you use kiss blocks on a C-frame press, you can prevent that cantilever action from happening when you're pressing down like this and your frame wants to open up on that side. If you use a kiss block, it keeps the pressure even. Just so you guys know, there's like a whole bunch of people that have been jumping in. Pickle's been like, yo, guys, what's up? Yeah. Brigham Pickle's Kendall great. Says what's up.
Yeah, shout out to Pickle if he's listening right now. Pickle was down last summer. We had a great time. We spent about a week foraging together. And a bunch of the boys came out, and we had a good couple days with everyone here, barbecues and drinks and drinks after the forging. Yep. But yeah, we got into a ton of fun with that last year. Yeah. Awesome,
dude. Yeah, I got go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're up.
Oh, I got Jason DeGuay coming to do a similar thing with me next weekend.
Nice. Ah, perfect. Yeah.
I'm stoked on that, dude.
It's humbling how tight knit and helpful this community is. I find people are just so open and it's just a great community to be a part of. I mean, there's just so much support network out there.
I can't believe how awesome it is, to be honest, man, compared to some of the other communities that I've been a part of in the past. Yeah, the blacksmithing community is rad, dude.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It's a small niche market of people, you know. There's not a lot of people who are into blacksmithing. So when you find other people who are into it, despite levels of how long you've been forging or your quality, everyone just picks up and forges together.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got to be a certain variety of loony to want to be a blacksmith. You know, that means that we get to hang out with our own.
It's true. It's kind of funny because I've totally gotten to this point where I kind of feel like I'm in my own world now, then, and it's all I need and nothing else really exists. And then I talk to people that are outside of the blacksmithing realm and it's like, you blacksmith? Holy shit. I didn't know anybody did that anymore. It's like, why?
Yeah. Get away from me. Hundreds of us. Hundreds.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know about where you guys are, but just on my one road here where I live, there's about four blacksmiths within 10 minutes drive of me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I know. Here in Ottawa, we're a little more spread out.
Yeah.
in Winnipeg, it's like where I am in a good 10-minute radius, probably 15-minute radius. I know about five guys.
Yeah. It's great having that community there. Yeah.
Have you hung out with Lawrence at all?
Yeah. Lawrence has been out here a couple times. He came last summer when Pickle was here. He brought us all some swag hats, and there were some stickers, and yeah, he brought some steel, and he forged an integral chef knife that day. Yeah.
That's awesome. So how the hell did you get hooked up with Lawrence, man? How did you manage to slide your hammers into his,
Oh, I'm not really sure. I think, we just got chatting about it one day,
You've been with him like since the beginning, right?
Not quite. Early on, probably during COVID, I guess. What's Lawrence been open now? 2.5 years?
Yeah, and I want to say like 2 years ago you jumped in?
Probably around then, yeah.
Yeah,
awesome, I think right as the restrictions were lifting, I hosted a hammer in here at my shop, and Lawrence came out, and it was shortly after that he started carrying a few of the tools. But we had talked about it before that as well. But it's nice to I'm not much of a social media person or an internet person. I don't have any websites or anything. I just run off of Instagram, Facebook primarily. But having Lawrence carry hammers and tongs for me has been great. Yeah. It's a nice way to advertise and get them out there. You know, Lawrence ships all over. So, yeah, spreads the tools around.
Oh, I think Lawrence did an amazing had an amazing decision process with going forward with getting your tools on board, because, man, you make some awesome stuff, dude.
Well, thanks, man. Appreciate that.
You make some very nice, clean hammers. You know, as a tool guy myself, I'm like, nice.
Oh, yep. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Actually, I reached out to you a while ago about making a hammer for me, and we got to talking, and it was like, well, what do you want for a hammer? And me being me, I'm like, dude, I don't know. I kind of want something like special and fancy, especially coming from you. I don't want to just get like something like whatever. And one of the things I've been looking into a lot lately when it comes to specialty hammers is silversmithing hammers.
You were looking for a leafing hammer at the time, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, but something like a little bit more, not quite a leafing hammer, a little bit more like, what do you call those? Like a dishing hammer kind of thing.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
So I started looking into silversmithing hammers, and I found this guy that's got like, gotta be 1,000, man, different freaking silversmithing hammers, all different shapes. And I'm just like, okay. I gotta figure out which one of these I want Peter to make for me, because I still want a freaking hammer from you so bad, dude.
Yeah, there's some great hammer makers in Canada, and I'd love to get some more of them. I've got one from Ryan over at True North Forge. It's
that's that feather pattern one.
It's incredible. It's 13 layers of wrought iron in a feather pattern Damascus feather pattern layers. Shush, dog. And then he's got forge welded faces on it, and it's just this incredible set hammer he made.
In a feather pattern.
I think it just about broke him. I mean, you can talk to him about that, but I think he just about gave up making that. It would have been a hell of a job to do, but he just completed his blacksmith course down in from California, I think it was. I shouldn't speak on his behalf, but for his final project, I think he used a set hammer to make his final piece for his journeyman's.
Was that for the CBA?
Yeah, California Blacksmith Association. Yeah,
nice. Yeah.
Do they actually offer certification?
Yep.
It's online now. So, yeah.
It's a newer thing, but yeah, it's.
Yeah.
And Abana recognizes it as well.
Oh, do they? Good. Yep. Nice. Yeah.
Abana's brought it in as part of their curriculum. So,
cool.
That's actually, I've been kind of wanting to reach out to Abana and ask them if they'd be interested in supporting the show in any sort of way, but I feel like at the same time we're like so not family friendly that maybe it's like
yeah, I think we might get a few side eyes.
Yeah, I think the executives.
Yeah.
They know about us. I know that, but yeah. So has this Fisher's been essentially your anvil since the get-go, or?
Yeah, I got it early on when I took up blacksmithing and built my first forge. I built was an old brake drum forge.
Classic.
Yeah. You got to start somewheres, right? And then from there, worked into propane forges, and then that's been my go-to anvil for the most part. I have had a few others over the years, but that's my primary anvil that I use. And then I've also got a Fisher Swage block. I think it's a number 2. I'm not entirely sure, but it's, it must be 200 pounds itself. Yeah. It's a lovely, swage block, an old one.
Awesome. Did you find that through your great grandfather as well?
Or? No, I got it from another, local blacksmith who was selling off some extra gear he had. Yeah.
Dude, that's just having a Fisher anvil and a Fisher Swage block. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Jealous.
So,
What about other tooling, top tooling, swages, spring swages, playing with that kind of stuff too?
A little bit. For the power hammer, I've made up a few bits of tooling here and there. Most of the tools I primarily use would be top tools. The problem with my power hammer being a mechanical hammer is I have a very small throw. Yeah. I can't work large sections of steel under it. So that's where the press is great, because I think I've got like an 8 or 9 inch throw on that. So I can put top tooling in and make nice depressions or flatters or anything that way. The power hammer.
We got opinions on whether or not you could use or should use top tooling on a press.
I'm in the same boat here, dude. Tell me more.
Yeah, so on the power hammer, I mean, it's great for drawing out tong reins and stuff like that. I'll make little bottom dies for the press, just for doing all my set lines and stepping shoulders and stuff like that. Yeah.
What about top tools on the press though?
Sometimes I'll use a flatter in there just to, but I'm not crunching it in. I'm just kissing it lightly. Yeah.
A lot of guys will say that's a recipe for disaster. I've done it with a little bit of success. I've never done anything crazy, but the conventional wisdom is no bueno.
No. In my press, I've got quite an assortment of different dies and punches for the press that I purchased from Coal Ironworks. So I don't really need to use tooling in those. I'm not using spring tools or anything. But if I wanted to set a shoulder on something, I might take a 2 inch block of steel and put just to get a half on, half off set down of thing. Yeah. Yeah. So, but I'm not using any spring tools in the press.
I do. Yeah, I do. All day, every day. That's all I got, man. I don't even have die sets yet. That's where I'm at right now. Is I just actually welded. I've always known that the way I built my press, that the bottom plate was just a flat 1 inch plate. That wasn't enough support, especially once I start putting proper dies in there. That the 1 inch plate was gonna flex. Even with the spring tools, I was seeing a lot of flex in there. So I've welded on 2 4-inch wide half inch plates down the entire length vertically underneath, kind of create almost like an I beam essentially, and that should stiffen the shit out of it. But the next process now is creating the die sets, like our die holsters, so that I can start putting dies in it, because using those spring swages is nice and all, but it's also a freaking pain in the butt, dude, because the spring swage can only go in one direction on an H frame, where on a C frame, I bet you it would be freaking fine.
Yeah.
But on an H frame, I can only put the spring swage in on one direction. And then, you know, it's getting all freaking mangled and shit, because I'll press down on it. And it's the way I've got my press set up. It's like half on the bench and half the other half, you know, like the, the spring itself starts pushing into the bench and shit. And next thing I know, I've got this mangled spring swage, and I'm just like, ah,
yeah,
this sucks.
No, it, for if you're trying to do stuff like fullering on a press, make yourself a set of fullering dots.
Exactly. Yeah. Like right, I've like got
that, that is the objectively better solution.
Yeah. For trough lines
spring,
on
spring
hammers,
swages like, and spring fullers are the kind of things that you could use under something like a self-contained air hammer, or if you're using the anvil, but trying to get that to work properly under the press, and the, with the risk of it kind of twisting, spitting, snapping, going, batoying.
Oh yeah,
you know, it's,
and it does that
it's
too.
It's just not a good idea. Just set your dies up.
That's no, the... if you're just doing planishing marks, though, you know, you can touch something up that way, but I wouldn't try to move a lot of metal fast under that kind of pressure. No. Yeah,
I've definitely texturing die that I do for bark.
Yeah,
I ran that down 1-inch solid bar like hard. And on just as a spring swage, and it was totally fine. But the thing with that being running it hard under the press is that it has, I don't care if it twists at all for doing texturing, right? It doesn't have to be perfect. And that's same right. thing if I'm doing fullering on something that's like somewhat of a, got an artistic flair to it or whatever, which is the majority of my work, right? I'm not too concerned if it's like not perfect. I actually don't want it to be perfect. So using the spring swage is actually like awesome in that aspect because I'm not going to get a perfect smush, mm-hmm. but I going to making hammers. I got it. I need that smush.
Have you ever made texturing hammers?
No, not
yet.
Oh,
they're a lot of fun. You just take a thin cutoff wheel and just do some random patterns in an old hammer you have. Just cut a couple
of
diagonal lines.
Weld and then regrind.
Oh, you get all these neat little triangular shapes that can pop up. You could even make a hammer with bark texturing, and then you can start hammering your own.
I was now that you say that, I lied. I do have a bark texturing hammer that I made, and it is so much more freaking work than using a spring swage.
Well, yeah.
Even by hand. Even using my spring swage with a hammer is better than using a texturing hammer. Let's take a quick break, guys. Okay, good day. Real quick here, I'm going to tell you about the Great Lakes Custom Knife Show, sponsored by Maritime Knife Supply. It's happening Saturday, August 19th in Goodrich, Ontario. It's Canada's largest knife show, and you can check out some of the best talent happening in the Canadian knife-making community. There's going to be lots of people there. You should go check it out. You can follow at Great Lakes Custom Knife Show on Instagram or visit greatlakescustomknifeshow.com. So we were talking about the texturing hammers and press dies and whatnot. And I definitely know I need to get into making the dies so that I don't use these spring swages and stuff like that. I'll be a world ahead of myself by having that set up. And I don't know, man. I've got this terrible bad habit that once it's like somewhat working, that's good enough.
You do the take it to the 80% where it does the job good enough, but you never quite finish it off all the way.
This is why I can't be a knife maker.
You only have to get to 70% to be a knife maker.
It was only 80% finished.
Don't matter.
I got to tell you what my biggest pet peeve is in the knife making world, and I don't see it as often anymore these days, but it's when somebody takes some precision ground bar stock and beats the shit out of it with a ball peen hammer and then grinds the shape out and then tries to pass it off as a forged knife or grinds my gears.
Crazy.
A ball peen hammer should never touch a knife. I don't care who you are. You should never touch a knife.
You got to be doing something real oddly specific. I wouldn't rule it out entirely, but like...
Hold on. I think I did that to the chopper I made.
I know.
I just wanted to put some texturing on it.
It's the worst. It looks so bad.
I don't know. I kind of like that forged texture look on
that's
it.
Not even forged.
That's why you forge it.
It looks like it was just abused with a ball peen. Right? You're absolutely right, Pete. There was a period of time where guys were doing that. And yeah. It was just like, oh, this drives me so nuts.
I only did
some of them were nice spine.
Yeah. I just did it to like the spine, essentially. Uh oh.
Even then. Well, Lando's got to go run away. We'll keep talking. Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I've forged stuff and yeah. had stuff go a little squirrely and had to grind it back into like true. And, yep. you know, let her sit in the forge a little bit too long, let her get a bit too much scale, take one of the sort of random texturing hammers, go back over it, throw it back in for some more forge scale, right? Like, just yep. to make it so that the ground spot doesn't, like, stick out like a sore thumb.
Right.
Right?
You know what
you know,
works
that's
really...
one thing.
You know what works really nice for that?
Where you need to grind some a section and then, like, you know, try to make it all match.
Do you have a needle scaler?
I have access to one, and I have used that for lots of different stuff.
Yeah, because you can hide a little grind mark with a needle scaler pretty quick.
Oh yeah, that one definitely helps. I sometimes find it's almost too aggressive. You really got to do it down at low heat.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, in a pinch, it really does work.
Yeah, great for removing forge scale too.
Yeah, actually, yeah. That's what I typically end up using it on. Like, when I do my hold fasts, I'll go with the scaler to make sure
they're scale free. Nice. Yeah, I was looking at some of your hold fasts online there, man. They're nice.
Yeah, I put a fair bit of work into getting those to actually be like, you know, nice, consistent, like a well-made, well-produced product that I can knock out consistently.
And they're consistent too, right? Because yeah. with all the jigs you have for forming and bending it to the precision shape every time, like, I mean, they were coming out top notch.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, they've still got some variation, right? Because I am.
As it should, it's handmade.
You know, yeah. I am manually doing my upset corners, right? Like, I've got to sit there and do that by hand. And that means the stem each time won't be the exact same length. The curvature on the inside
yeah.
won't be exactly the same. But I think that's kind of okay. Like, yeah. it is a handmade thing. Like, I do spend a fair bit of time actually at the anvil with those, even with most of the, like, heavy process work done under the power hammer with the different little jigs and dies.
Yeah. Nice. So, very good.
Thanks, man. Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty proud of those. I've got to do another run of them again soon. People have been asking me about them over and over again. It's like, I'll get to them. Come on.
Are you primarily making woodworking tools?
That is kind of my niche. Right.
Yeah.
I make woodworking tools. I'll do like some, I'll do some odds and ends of like hardware and stuff like that. Like, I've been helping out my buddy Jack Forsberg do a restoration for a local like grist mill, like an old flour
nice.
Mill
yeah.
from like the 1870s. Right. He's doing yeah. a big retrofit of the line system in there. It's all line drives. And, you know, it's a museum. You've got to make the hardware look the part. So I've been forging nails and making washers and, you know, even just blackening stuff so that it doesn't look out of place, you yep. know, but for the most part, when I'm making stuff, I am making woodworking tools for the, let's be frank, mostly people who are doing kind of like a high-end hobby.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I do have some professional woodworkers who buy my stuff for, you know, some things. It's mostly the guys who are like the real enthusiasts who like to get a hold of my stuff.
Cool. Yeah, nice, man. It's a good market to delve into.
Yeah, there's not that many guys out there doing woodworking tools.
No, there's not.
You
really,
should try selling blacksmith tools to blacksmiths. Woodworkers can't make their own metal tools.
This is one.
And
of
there's
the
a lot more woodworkers than blacksmiths out there. So yeah.
No, but the one thing is that you've got at least got a little bit of a niche going. That it's the guys who are the bladesmiths who are sort of your focus.
Yes,
and I know a fair number of bladesmiths who do like to go and just buy their tooling, just because
well,
they haven't sat there and developed and practiced all those skills for like tong making and stuff like that, where they'll just, you know, it's not worth their time to them to make a set of tongs. You know,
it's not
when they can use that time to be grinding up blades or whatever, and then tongs arrive in the mail.
Well, that's what most guys tell me is, you know, they can make two knives in a day, forge them out, and grind them and get them heat treated. But to make a set of tongs to do a job is going to take them all day to make a set of tongs when they can make money doing something that they've been practicing in, right? So
cost effectiveness, right?
Yeah. Well, it's actually interesting. Like, for a very long time in blacksmithing history, guys were specialized. Yeah, you always do have some people who are generalists kicking around, but, you know, blacksmithing as a trade was highly specialized, right? Mm. And it was only when the Industrial Revolution kicked around that blacksmiths started to need to be this sort of, like, you know, jack of all trades, where they would be able to shoe horses and make knives and make tools and make, you know, equipment, do equipment repairs and forge small parts and hardware and all this different stuff. You know, it was the only way they could kind of keep themselves going. But now there seems to be an increase again in the sort of specialization, which I think is generally a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sometimes I get a little bit like, about just how many knife makers there are. But I mean, because of Forge and Fire, there was a large number of people who got into it from that. And because of Forge and Fire, there's a big market. So it does make sense.
Yeah. The influx of knife makers almost made me step back a little bit from knife making and delve into other areas. I always like to be sort of on my own on the sidelines doing my thing. And it takes the novelty away from me when there's too many people around you doing it. You know, going into the tool making was the next step. And I love making tools, you know, make them for myself and I enjoy the process, but I also enjoy the knife making, you know, stepping away from the grinder and the hand sanding is definitely nice. It gets a bit tedious after a while.
Oh God, does it ever. I still have to do a lot of that whenever I do like Damascus tools or anything that needs like precise surfaces. And it's just like, the pain. Yeah. Hours and hours and hours of sanding.
I think knife making is 20% forging and about 80% hand sanding, right?
Yeah, when it comes to time, you're probably right.
Yeah, because I can forge a rough billet in, you know, depending on the knife style, anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour, and then your knife's ready for grinding and everything. But then you spend, you know, several hours polishing out the bevels or the handle and smoothing it out. You know, it just takes forever. Yeah, getting all those little scratch marks out and every little bit. Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you do anything like stonewashing or?
I played with different finishings over the years, but I think what I found works best for me is leaving the forge texturing on the main part of the blade and then just polishing up the cutting edge.
Oh yeah.
And then the spine and around the handle. Brute to forge, I think a lot of guys call it, but for me that saves a lot of hand sanding and because it's handmade, I want it to show the imperfections and the hammer blows and, you know, the sweat and tears that go into every piece. Stock removal, you know, that's pretty simple. I find acid etch too is something that helps. I don't like shiny things. I like, you know, more of a satin finish or something a little grayed. So most of my knives will have some sort of acid finish on them. It just helps force a little bit of a patina on it, saves it from rusting as easy, especially when you have a nice high polished blade and you're out at the camp or in the woods and you cut up a piece of meat. Next thing you know, the tannin lines have discolored the blade immediately, you know? So.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's just like those guys who spend so much time doing mirror finishes on blades. It's just like, is it really worth it? Like, I know sometimes customers want it, right? At that point it is worth it. But especially if you were going to make something like on spec, you know, like speculative, like for people just to take a look at, like mirror polishing, it's like so much work. And then like you breathe on it the wrong way and it rusts.
But Damascus isn't much different, or pattern welded steel. I mean, you're only etching the surface. After you use that kitchen knife a half a dozen times, that pattern starts to wear off too. You know?
That's why I really like the guys that are letting it etch a little bit deeper than just surface etching and getting some grooves in there like that. And but you know, like I've heard a lot of people argue that that's terrible for catching food and you got to be careful about that. But like, let's be honest, if you're washing your knife properly, that's not something you're going to have to worry about too much.
If you treat it like a cast iron skillet or something, it'll serve you well if you maintain it. But a lot of people, let's be honest, don't take care of their things after the first week or two. They start to just treat it like every other kitchen knife or every other hunting knife they've ever owned. It goes back in the sheath for a year with blood still on it and doesn't get cleaned, you know? Mm.
Like I think that there is definitely like middle grounds in there. Like, you know, if you're doing a kitchen knife, don't etch it so deep that you're going to get texture, because it's not just about the food. It's bacteria has spaces where it can stay and hide. Even if
not, unless you had a D-lam, you wouldn't have bacteria staying in the blade.
You can get little spots where essentially you've got layers that are sort of starting to fold over a bit. And then in between there, you can get a little pocket where if there's just like, if you can't clean it perfectly, there is the possibility of there being something. Now, I'm not saying this is going to be like a major issue for anyone.
But right? One could say the same thing about wood handles on a knife.
Exactly, right?
Well,
right?
They do say that about wood handles. Like the kitchen industry is kind of against wood handles at this point, if I'm not mistaken.
They want to be able to sterilize everything, right? But if you're a home cook and it's your stuff and you're taking care of the knife, it's a different thing. You know, like I personally would never want a Damascus kitchen knife, but that's just me. Like I probably just want like a really nice carbon steel knife.
The stainless Damascus kitchen knife would be all right.
Potentially, you know, like it's going when we start getting into the stainless steels and stuff, we're going a little bit outside of my zone of authority, right? Like, I like to be able to comment on stuff and be like, okay, there is a rational sort of thing behind this. But we start getting into anything with stainless steel, I'm like,
argh. What about this stuff that, like Baker Forge and Tools doing with the copper and the brass and whatnot in the blade? And is that stuff that you want to be utilizing in a kitchen? Or what do you guys think about that? What's your thoughts?
Well, I mean, copper is naturally like antimicrobial, but
it is.
I don't know that that's amount of copper on a steel blade is going to make a difference. All right, you need to talk to somebody who gets like real into like sanitation.
Yeah, I know in the construction industry, Reese used copper on the peaks of roofs years ago, and as it would rain, the rain would wash down and it would kill any moss on the roof.
Yeah.
So it's right. That's how you keep the moss from growing on a roof. If you have, you know, trees overhanging or something along those lines. But, you know, really, the kitchen is probably just as high in bacteria levels as your bathroom is, right? Your cutting boards aren't getting washed with boiling water every time you wipe it down. Right. So you're talking micro points on the bacteria level here. I think our immune system should probably just be a little bit stronger maybe overall.
There is something to be said there.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. When it comes to like kitchen knives, I think, you know, if somebody is really into Damascus, you know, and wants a Damascus kitchen knife, I think there's nothing wrong with it. I wouldn't etch it like too super deep and just know the fact that it's going to develop some patina over time and that pattern isn't going to be as like pop out bold. But
any Damascus, whether it's etched deep or not,
the
etchant will eat away the steel, but it doesn't make the etchant deeper into the steel. It's still on the surface.
Yeah, right. The color.
So whether you etch it deep, you can get the wavy lines in there, but it's still going to take a patina. You'll see those etchant lines in there, but it's the Damascus pattern of the nickel not reacting to the acid, and the carbon steel's reacting to the acid, you're still going to lose your contrast, let's say.
You don't want it deep enough that, you know, if you're holding water on the blade, that the water, and you roll the blade, that the water is trapping in the grooves. You want it enough that water is going to run smoothly off, maybe ripple over top of the grooves or whatever, right? But it's nice to feel them. Like, I don't know. That's my personal opinion. I like to feel it.
Or you can just take a ball peen hammer to it and get the same effect.
Oh. Shut up.
Get us started on that again.
It's like one of the first things I ever made, dude. Jeez.
It still grinds my gears. I didn't know you made one with a ball peen hammer, but good on you for having a go at it.
Well, I mean, yeah. I didn't make the entire blade with the ball peen hammer. I forged it out with a normal hammer. Well, what was the normal hammer? I can't even remember what I used to forge it out, to be honest.
Probably the flat side of the ball peen hammer.
No, I had a rounding hammer back then, I think, that I was using, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
What was your first forging hammer you ever got?
First forging hammer I ever used was it was a double flat faced hammer that was like a 3-pound hammer from Princess Auto. And yeah, we rounded off one side to make it a more of a rounding hammer. And
like an engineer's hammer.
No,
it's octagon shape with flat cheeks.
Yeah, but I thought the engineer's hammer. I thought that's an engineer's hammer is a cross peen.
No, engineer's hammer is usually just a little. It's like a little mini sledge,
mini mall.
And that is absolutely what I started with, a Canadian Tire engineer's hammer.
Except knock the fiberglass handle out and put a wood one in right away.
No, thankfully got mine with a wood handle from the
store. Okay. Mine came with a wood handle.
A horrific wood handle. It was like way too big. But
nice.
Yeah, that and a bunch of ball peens. And this whole rounding hammer thing wasn't nearly as popular when I started.
I tried making my own hammer right off the hop too, and I thought it was something that was super. I was like, oh yeah, I know what I'm doing. Look at this hammer I made. And I remember Derek Melton being like, maybe don't pat yourself on the back so hard there, pal.
Oh, no. I'm like, soul crushing there, bud. You know, it's a hammer, but it's a long way to go.
I don't know if you even want to call it a hammer, to be honest. I still have it. I have it on my rack, and I'm going to keep it on the rack just, you know, as a reminder of where I started, right? But, oh, gosh. Yeah. It's terrible.
Oh, you got to keep some of your early projects so that you can see exactly how far you've come.
Wall of shame.
I don't know if you looked on my Instagram. I don't know. It must have been about a year ago. I put a post up. It was the first hammer I ever forged, and I forged it by hand. Yeah, I think it took me the better part of 2 days, to be honest. And then there was my daily driver, which I use all the time in the same weight class. And then there was a new one that I had just forged. And it just showed the
progression,
the growth and the changes in the shape and design over the years. Yeah. But it was a bit humbling to line the three of them up at one point. Are you finding it there, Nick?
Yeah, I just pulled up the post.
Yeah.
To be perfectly frank, if that was your first one, that ain't half bad, dude.
I tell you, for the trough lines, I had zero tools when I made that one for making hammers. And I had this old big leaf spring, and I set the steel on the anvil, and I beat the leaf spring in to make the trough lines.
It took
forever. Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to remember what I used for the trough lines on my first hammer. I think we made a spring swage. Can't remember for sure, but
did you have a striker?
I may have had a striker for a portion of it.
Yeah,
but I've made like about 50 hammers and or axes by hand at this point, and I don't want to ever make another one by hand, to be honest. Oh god,
punching that eye is a nightmare if you're forging on your own by hand.
Yeah,
that's a big task to take on, I love my punch press for the hydraulic press. Honestly, one heat, you just go right down 70%, flip it over, punch the slug out on the other side, and then back in the fire and heat it up and drift it through. You know, it's wow, it's so quick.
What do you do as far as maintaining center and ensuring that nothing like tilts to the side or anything like that? Is it just all eye-hand coordination or?
Yeah, you develop different techniques as you go along. Sometimes, you know, the punch can slip off a little bit as you're punching that first slug. What I like to do is, depending on what hammer style I'm making, I'll forge a square billet first, and then I usually let it cool, and then I'll measure off and I'll punch a mark for the center on both sides. And then I can put it under the press and just kiss that mark before I punch it through. And then that way, when I'm coming in hot, I've got an indexing that I can line the punch up with. And it's great to rotate it as you're going down in case even your press or your dies have any side kick to them in any little slight way. It'll help keep the eye from offsetting to one side.
Spin it 180 type thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you're striking by hand or if you're making a hammer by hand and you have a striker, you should be rotating it constantly and flipping it, rotating it constantly as you go.
Yeah, and you do the exact same thing if you're like, I'm lucky enough that I've got a self-contained air hammer. Same thing. You know, it's nice. It's a lot faster, but you definitely have to be conscious of the fact that, you know, you punch down a little ways, flip it around, punch down a little ways, flip it around.
Yeah.
You prefer to do it on your mechanical hammer versus, or your air hammer, sorry, versus your press?
Yeah, I do. I've had too many problems over the years with going to punch under a hydraulic press and getting the billet stuck on the punch and then having to figure some way out to get that damn hammer off the punch.
You're not using top tools when you do that on your press, are you?
No. No, nothing silly like that. It probably would work better if I did, frankly. But yeah, no, I had a punch and stripper plate thing set up. But
yeah.
I've always had problems with punches getting stuck doing it under the hydraulic press.
Yes. I
find it works easier for me.
Anytime I've tried drifting wedges for the eye under the press, I usually end up having to go to the swage block and beat them out. They don't last too long. They mar up pretty quick under the press if you're drifting your eyes after you punch it. But the H13 holds up really well for punching holes, I find. Yeah.
I don't know. I actually ended up making an H13 punch die. Just didn't do it. Now, admittedly, it could have been geometry, could have been the finish on it. Maybe it wasn't a fine enough finish and just had too much friction. Yeah. You know,
what are you using for lube?
I was using like the beeswax and graphite mix.
Have you tried the Fuchs?
No.
You should. You can. I think Front Step Forge is selling it now. But Coal Ironworks also sells it. You can just order a little cans of that. But if you're just using your press and punching it in little by little, use the Fuchs, and I've never had any problems with it sticking.
Yeah, I think that's also maybe a bit of a technique thing on my part. Like I might have centered a little too hard.
Right. It's amazing how that little bit extra is enough just to like lock it in. The worst is when the end of your punch
mushrooms
out. Oh, I've had to cut hammers off before and throw them away and then make something little out of the two halves.
You know what I did last time that happened to me is I pushed it right through.
Oh, really? You just put like a die plate on the bottom to punch it out? Or
Bolster
plate, I mean. Yeah.
Well, no, I ended up taking it out of the press and just punched it through by hand.
Oh, okay.
Put it on top of, I have a bolster plate because I don't have enough room under the press to do that. So I put it in the bolster plate and I just punched it out by hand. I started wailing on it till it started coming through and then
just kept giving her till it popped.
Yeah.
How's the new press working out for you? That was a project that was long in the works, eh?
Yes and no, actually. I mean, it's still long in the works is the problem. Is I got it going, and then I was like, okay, well, it's going, and now I'm just going to use it with the spring swages and stuff, right? But it's working awesome, dude. I'm super happy with it.
That's great, man. Good.
It was like a game changer having this thing going instead of having to do everything by hand, especially the texturing that I'm doing for the bark texturing, dude. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, game changer. Not doing that by hand. Honestly, to do that by hand, it would take a good 5 blows like in each spot with a 4-pound hammer, and then I'd have to rotate it, do like another 5 blows, rotate it, and then move it. And it was only like a 3-inch block that I'm using for a die under the press. It's like meh, 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 just churn every time. What, like one press churn, one press churn, one press churn. And because the dies are rounded, I don't have to worry about losing the round on the bar. So yeah, no, it's perfect. Awesome, dude. I'm super happy with it. I wish it was a little bit bigger, that I had more room under it, but I got,
when you're doing your texturing, have you ever considered using like a hardwood block underneath your wood? It'll smoke up on you, but you won't crush out your texturing on the bottom side.
That's why I use a spring die.
Okay. It's got texturing on the bottom too.
On both sides, yeah.
Okay, nice, perfect, yeah.
Yeah. So, and the texturing die I made was like super simple to make. It was just take two blocks and round it out the center of them a little bit, and then take an angle grinder with a cutting disc and cut grooves into it.
Nice.
Yeah, super simple.
You made an acorn die, didn't you, as well?
I didn't make that. I actually bought that from Smedjefrost in Sweden.
Okay.
Yeah, I've bought a few dyes from him, actually. In the past, I bought some flower dyes from him, and I ended up giving one of those to Rank and File, Steve Rankin. And I kind of wish I wouldn't have split that up. I should have kept both dyes, because honestly, you want both, like top and bottom, especially for the acorn anyway, so you can make it like, you know, the 360 effect, 3D. Or 3D effect. Yeah. 3D.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you're just doing, I have done one sided one, and then I can put my touch mark on the back side of it, right? Which works good for like a little keychain or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But for artistic like sculpture, I want to be able to do a full actual acorn.
Right. Making some nice wine racks or something with the acorns three dimensional all the way around hanging off or something.
Yeah.
I mean, if you get creative, you could have them sit against stuff. So the fact that they're not fully in the round, you know, doesn't
matter. I guess so. Yeah. Yeah. You could do that. Yeah. If you're just on like a flat plate or something like that, and you're doing something like that,
I think there's lots of ways you can still use that.
Yeah. Cool.
Yes, sir. Are you, you got anything special like that when it comes to dyes, or are you doing anything artistic at all ever? Or?
I do for myself. There was supposed to be a blacksmith maker's market here back in, I think it was April, but it ended up, so I was making a bunch of stuff up then, a bunch of, horse head bottle openers and little lantern hooks and candle bowls and, nice. That kind of stuff, just to have, most people come into a maker's market, don't want to buy a blacksmith hammer or, a handmade knife. Right. So you had to have those little niche things, but, it ended up getting canceled. Most of the stuff I forge that's more sort of artistic or decor would be just for my own home. Lots of little trinkets, and sometimes, I get the kids out in the shop and they forge little things. They've done snakes and ferns. And so I just mount those and put them in the house and put them around that way.
Well, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
So, 9 and 10.
Nice.
Yeah.
Boys, girls?
Boys. Yeah, both boys.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah. Some of my proudest memories are when they come out to the shop. I never force them, never ask them. I always just let them come to it on their own abilities. And when they come out and we spend a day out there, that's always heartwarming and touching. Yeah.
That's awesome, dude.
Yeah.
My dad and my grandpa were at the house last weekend because it was my kid's 7th birthday, and they came out to the shop and checked it out, and both of them were like, "Oh, you really seem to know what you're doing here, kid. Good for you." And it was just like, "Yeah, I've been telling you that for fucking years, you hosers." Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great when you see younger people getting involved or interested in the craft.
Oh, actually, dude, that was one of the best things about my kid's birthday was she had a bunch of her friends from school come for – there was like two separate birthday parties, one for her friends from school and then one for family and like close friends type thing, right?
Yeah.
And the school kids came earlier in the day, and at the end of their little stint of being here, there was – about an hour of free time, and after half an hour of them playing, they started kind of, I could hear them like arguing, "It's my turn, she's not giving me a turn." So I go in the yard, and you know, I kind of, you know, "Come on girls, like give each other a turn," and I'm like, "Hey, you guys want to see the shop and see what I do and check out, you know, what a blacksmith does?" And they're like, "Yeah, let's do it." And my kid was like, "Come on dad, show us." And yeah, it was just, that was very heartwarming to bring a bunch of grade one students, all girls, into my shop. Yes. And have all of them just being like super enthusiastic about what I do, asking a bunch of questions. And yeah, that was great.
Yeah, that's memories that'll stick with them, you know, when they're older and looking back at their childhood, they'll remember those days for sure.
That's yeah. Super cool.
That's the hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, just, you know, even if it was even okay, so like maybe I didn't turn them into a blacksmith in their later years, but maybe they'd got that bug in their head that just making stuff and like, what is this? What is it that this world is that we are encountered with? Like, what do we do with ourselves? And what do we do in this world that we're living in? And maybe it's an engineer or a geologist or something that's just like interested in like, what this world is, like, you know, science. Ooh. Right, versus being sitting behind a desk and pushing pen and paper, man. I don't know.
I think it's nice to also just learn the value of something handmade too. You know, the time and the effort and skill that goes into making something rather than just going to Walmart and buying it. Yeah
for sure.
Appreciation.
No, I think that you can teach them that there's value in those things. They're not the same.
That's right. Yeah. Try and explain that to clients too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, good God. Why is it so expensive? I could buy that at Walmart for this much. It's like, first off, no, you can't. But if you are satisfied with the thing from Walmart, you go do that, because this is not what you're looking for.
The way I describe it to most people – oh, sorry, Lando, I cut you off there.
No, go ahead.
The way I describe it to most people is I work in the trades. So on a job site, I'm using Milwaukee or DeWalt or Makita tools, you know, something that's $400 or $500. But let's just talk cordless drills, for example. You know, if I'm working on a site, that's the tools that I'm using. But for the average homeowner to go to Canadian Tire and buy a $50 Mastercraft cordless drill, that'll solve all their needs. But it's those people who want to branch out and have the higher quality tools because they're passionate about what they do, whether it be a chef or a hunter or someone who spends a lot of time in the woods with a knife, or somebody who likes a nice tool or a chisel or a woodworking, you know,
I disagree with you because coming from learning my lesson, buy the fucking nice stuff.
Don't waste
your money on the Mastercraft drill. Go buy the Milwaukee tool. Don't waste your money on the Walmart knife. Go buy a custom made knife from a good blacksmith that knows what the hell they're doing. Like, you're going to appreciate the difference for the rest of your life.
And while we have a vested interest in encouraging this philosophy, as people who make these things, I think that's got to be a personal decision for everybody, because there's, you know, like, I own shitty stuff,
But that's the thing.
Some of it is perfectly fine for what I'm doing, right? You know, like I've got a screwdriver I keep around my house. It's one of those like slidey bit ones from Home Hardware. The thing's a piece of junk, right? But you know, for tightening down the occasional screw at the house, it's like, yeah, you know, the cheapo shit works fine. You know, am I going to have that at my workshop when I'm actually trying to do stuff? No. But, you know, I think there does need to be a little bit of context added to that argument.
But it's also how much you're using it and to what ability you're using it as well, exactly. Right? If you're hanging curtain rods, then a $50 Mastercraft cordless drill is all you need. But if you're building houses and decks and putting up drywall, that $50 Mastercraft drill is going to burn out on you pretty quickly.
Probably the first week.
I want to go with the screwdriver bit. You go yourself and buy the cheap ass screwdriver set from Bargain Bin versus buying a nice set, a decent set from even a screwdriver set from Home Hardware or Canadian Tire. You can get decent sets of screwdrivers, but yeah. I'm going to go with decent, but you go with a cheap ass set from the Bargain Bin, you go to turn one screw and you're going to strip out your freaking screwdriver. Just wasted your bloody money, like, and your time.
What if you only need to put in one screw?
There's also a bottom limit to this, right?
Yeah, you're taking it to the extreme, Lando.
Once again, I think this conversation needs to be treated with a bit of nuance.
We were talking about Walmart.
Yeah, I have purchased things from Walmart that I still have to this day and work fine.
It's the kind of thing that I hardly use, right?
Yeah. I need to have it around for like a, you know, like the oddball chance that I'm going to use.
I've got tools from Princess Auto that you know, they're something I reach for once every 6 or 10 years. You know, I still want it to be the best.
Yeah, I've got a set of Princess Auto feeler gauges.
Yeah.
Right. They are everything that I need in terms of feeler gauges. I use feeler gauges basically never. I even took one of them and cut it off to use it as a piece of shim stock. And I didn't feel bad about it because it was from Princess Auto.
You could probably return it and get another set.
I probably could.
I guess there's a certain point where it's like, yeah, okay, it doesn't matter, but I don't know, man. I don't know. You're talking anything that you want to ever, like, actually use and expect results.
Again, as long as you treat the conversation with nuance, it's fine.
Yes, right.
Orlando, you're speaking from a point of view of someone who uses tools for a living, and I'm very much in the same mindset as you. I buy top quality tools, but somebody who works as, I don't know,
But this is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about my previous life when I didn't work with tools, when I worked in freaking retail and I was going into computer programming in college and I didn't know freaking Phillips from a Robertson. Like, I was clueless back then, dude. Until I took welding in 2000 and graduated in 2004 and started actually using tools all the time, I was useless, dude. Like, right. I might as well have been a person that just played video games all day long.
But you weren't buying Snap-on tool chests when you were doing computer programming, were you? Right? Now that your lifestyle needs a better tool, you're reaching out for the better quality tools.
But I did buy a tool chest then, and it was a cheap, crappy ass, I don't know where it came from, that just fell apart. I look back now on it and I wish I would have had a Snap-on that I still have now to this day.
Yeah.
Well, everybody needs to learn the lesson at least once.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think we've all learned that lesson at least once. There could be fool's advice,
like just like mountains of it ahead of you. You still got to learn it yourself. Everybody will buy the Kmart hammer once.
I'm a screaming example.
Did Kmart sell hammers?
Probably, yeah. Kmart did indeed sell hammers. That one is a specific reference to my dad, if he ever listens to the show. My grandfather once bought a Kmart hammer and it lasted one swing.
Yeah. It's like buying they were the hollow tube handles, weren't they?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, I think my first hammer was one of those.
Oh, no.
I was like 17, yeah.
Oh, my dad refused. You know, like he would not let me buy like crappy tools or even like when I was a little kid, I wasn't allowed to have toy tools.
Well, I feel like I'm like kind of like your dad. Yeah, exactly. Right?
But I still have bought crappy things. I still went out and bought a shite hammer once and it lasted 3 swings.
Like, I'll even.
And ever since I bought S-Wing.
You know what? Here's a really good example of don't buy crap. When I first got into snowboarding, I didn't know that I was going to enjoy snowboarding or not. I was pretty sure I was going to enjoy snowboarding. I bought a super cheap snowboard. Started hitting the slopes. I struggled so hard to become a decent snowboarder. A few years later, I went out and spent more money on a decent snowboard. And I started doing better. And then a year later, after that, buying that decent snowboard, I was like, holy crap, that like really made a difference. After a year of that, I went out and bought a good snowboard. And it was, and I bought good boots and good bindings, the whole kebab. And it was just a game changer. I went from being a guy that could barely ride down the hill properly to a guy that was hitting, like, was doing competition riding, dude.
Nice, man.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it makes a difference to say fuck the cheap shit and just go straight to the good shit right off the hop. And I mean, if you're into hunting, you go and you buy a cheap crappy knife from Walmart, you're out in the field trying to skin a deer and it's not cutting through properly, or you get partway through and now it's lost its edge and you can't cut any further. You're going to struggle. You're going to curse and swear to yourself that you should have bought that nice knife from a freaking good blacksmith.
Yeah, but like I said, everybody needs to learn that lesson.
And I think
no matter how many times you tell people, they've got to learn it themselves.
If you haven't learned it yet, you got to learn it. But maybe you have learned it and you're looking for a blacksmith to make you a good knife. You can head over to smithlist.ca and find a directory of blacksmiths Canada-wide. There's suppliers, events, everything available to you at smithlist.ca. That's a website that I helped coin with a friend of mine in Quebec. He did all the work and put up the website himself. And it's been a growing entity ever since.
That's a great website, too.
It is.
Thanks. Yeah, I registered on there and put my name in there when you guys first set it up. It was super easy. Yeah, it was great.
I think I'm on there. I've got to go back and check.
I think you are. I'm pretty sure you are.
I think I am.
Yeah. Lando put you in there just out of...
I don't go looking for blacksmiths. I don't know. I never go on the site.
Here's a question for you guys. Do you wear an apron or do you not when you're forging?
Never.
No?
I'm horrible for it. I can't. Never do.
I've got an apron, but I've got a 2 or 3 in there, but sometimes I wear it, sometimes I don't. It depends what I'm wearing when I go to the shop.
Yeah. This is one thing for me is I'm starting to look into getting into like the historical reenactment sort of world.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if I'm gonna be like making myself period clothes to be able to do this, you better believe I'm gonna get myself a sword out with an apron so I don't burn holes and all.
Yeah.
You know, my standard work t-shirts, I do not care. They're all full of holes anyways.
Yeah. But, I'm the same way.
My wardrobe is go ahead.
Only time I will wear an apron is if I know I'm going to be doing some like super heavy grinding. Wire wheel is a good one to wear an apron with. Otherwise, you'll be a pinhead in your belly type thing, right?
Oh, God.
I found wire wheels in my...
I've gotten one right in the dickhead, dude.
I found them in my underwear after wire wheeling. It's awful. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I know, and I still don't learn.
Yep, same here. Same.
Everyone
here.
Has to learn that lesson once, Nick.
I think I learned that lesson lots of times and still hasn't stuck.
Well, technically,
apparently
it did
I'm
stick.
A little thick. Oh, okay. If we want pretty to steer good. Away from back that whole conversation, there is one question that I kind of like to ask people. And if time and money and materials and stuff wasn't really like a barrier to you, you have something that would be like a dream project for you to
Nice question, dude.
Ooh. Yeah, I'd like to get into sword making. That's always been a passion project of mine. The old broadswords, the English swords. I've always had an affinity towards those. I have dabbled in that a little bit. Anything sort of medieval time period, you know. I think as a kid just growing up, anything that had a sword in it, I was just enthralled with. I couldn't take my eyes off of it. That was sort of the draw for me. Here, I'll go on a little tangent and go off on a sidebar here. But so my knife making, I had started independently, just learning where I could and reading and whatnot. And after about probably close to like 8 years or so into knife making as a hobbyist, I got to spend some time with a great knife maker named Randall Graham. And he's since passed away. But we spent about 2 months working together, and I learned a lot from him. Now, Randall Graham was down in the States for quite a number of years and was one of the probably higher-end known knife makers. Him and Howard Clark used to do a lot of work together and were good friends. And if you know Howard Clark, you'll know who probably Randall is. But so I spent some time with him and Randall, he used to do a lot of Japanese style swords and everything, but then he got into a very simplistic style of forging where it was very basic tools, very minimalistic. And it was all about just forging 95-98% finish. And, so there was a project when, near the end of our time together, I had a couple pieces of steel, and I had some brass, and I had some wood, all parts that I had sort of compiled from friends and people who I knew and respected. And so I've actually got this piece sitting right here in front of me. Now, this was very early on in my forging days, but this was made with nothing but a hammer and a file.
Nice.
And so this was my introductory into sword making. So it's, you know, I call it the Hobbit toothpick kind of idea.
Yeah.
You know, all the concepts of this blade are traditional sword making. And so this is something where I'd like to probably go someday if time was, and cost and finish wasn't an option. That's where I'd probably take it. But
does that have a peened pommel?
It does. Yeah. I see if I can get it.
Nice.
Yeah
no, I caught now, a little glimpse of that, and I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, no, good. I do a lot of peen finishes. Almost all of my through tang knives always have a peened dome on the pommel.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I tell you, getting a polished peen is a very tricky and time expensive process with files and sandpaper and not getting cracks and splits in it and getting that nice symmetrical dome.
It's a royal pain in the ass.
Yeah, I think a lot of people oversight that. Yeah, if you look, I think I put one on Instagram. There was an old Puko I had done, and it's got a beautiful peen on it. I don't know if you're looking it up there, Nick.
I've been trying to convince my wife to polish my peen for a few months. Not working out so well. Been in the doghouse.
Good luck with that.
Oh, is it the one with the different segments in the handle?
No, go down further. There's another one. I think it's on here. Here it is. It's a black and white photo. There's a simple Puko. Yeah. Nobody can see the photos, eh? So there's see this one here, Nick? Look for that photo.
Okay.
What's the date on it?
It is.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
But you see the button peen on that?
Yeah.
It's all polished up. Thanks, man.
That must have taken a dog's age.
I don't remember how long it took, but yeah, there's a lot of work that goes into those, and it's the small intricacies that, you know, as a knife maker or just a blacksmith, when you pick up other people's work and you see these small details and pick up on it, and you start to know the level of the quality of the work that somebody's putting out.
I especially love picking up somebody else's knife or tool or whatever and going like, ooh, I know what you did there.
Yeah.
That's tricky.
Yeah. You know, those ones I always love seeing those little niche.
That's going to take a shit ton of work.
And everyone does it differently too, right? Yeah. So, yeah. It's always fun. You can learn something from new and old. It's always great to getting together with people and seeing their technique or how they do something, because you can always pick up little tips and tricks with your ears and your eyes, as opposed to watching YouTube or something, right?
So, oh, absolutely. It's often a lot of fun to go and like be able to kind of like look at somebody else's work and kind of see where they're at and kind of remember back to like if you were there. You know,
that's
like,
right. Yeah.
Like we recently had Joey Plant on the podcast, and I got to look at some of his work beforehand. And it's one of those things, like, he's only been knife making for 3 years. And he's doing some amazing stuff. Like, and especially the kind of like rigorous testing he puts his blade through. Blades through are really admirable. You know, but I got to sit there and look, and you can see, like, you know, how he did the guard. And you can see little sort of like, you know, like you could tell he's not using jigs because he's got a little bit of like variation in the height of his plunge lines and stuff. And it's like, I so remember being at that stage, you know, and learning and developing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like if
there's some amazing new makers coming.
I was not 3 years in when I was producing the kind of stuff that Joey is. That guy has got way more talent than I do.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I love seeing the progression of people's work and just seeing where they've taken it to and all the effort they put into it and recognizing that, you know. Unless you're doing it yourself, it's really hard for the average person to recognize how much work and time and effort and learning has gone into the craft that they do.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah.
Speaking of progression in my work, one of the things that I found that helped progress my work a little bit, actually quite a bit, was connecting with the Twiller Linseed products. I started using some of his stuff in the last year or so here, maybe a couple years now, actually, to be honest. And man, I'll tell you what, he keeps developing new stuff too, which is awesome. And some of the new stuff that he developed and that I've gotten my hands on, I was like super pumped about the Lind Shield. I don't know, man. The added little carnauba wax to it it gives a completely different shell than just the beeswax does. It's really nice, and it, like, it hardens differently. And I keep calling it the flax wax. It's not actually called flax wax. I was like, we nicknamed it the flax wax. It's got a different name to it. I can't remember what it is for sure now, actually, because I've just been calling it flax wax for so long. Freaking love that stuff, dude. Even apply it hot so it boils right into the steel. Oh, yeah.
Nice.
LaRoquez actually showed up down at the Hammerin, down at the Delta Mill Forge, and he had brought some of it along, and I was actually pretty impressed by it. It's cool stuff.
Yeah.
Really good for hot finishing work.
If you haven't gotten your hands on any yet, you can head over to thetwillerlinseed.com and put in an order. You can use the code it's ForgeChat10. That's the code. Thank you. The way you looked
about
at me.
About jumping, but you got it.
ForgeChat10 at checkout, and they'll save you 10% on orders $50 or more. Didn't mention the fact that this stuff is like homegrown Canadian made stuff too. So, I mean, just saying, can't beat that.
I mean, it's pretty cool. You got a guy who is like literally farming the flax to make the linseed oil to make the products. It's, you know,
that's crazy, man.
It's
how much flax do you need to make a liter of linseed oil?
Yeah, it's that kind of like level of craft that we just all appreciate.
Yeah, from blacksmiths for sure.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I can't remember. If you go back in our episode list, we did have an interview with him at one point, Dawson.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I can't remember what episode number that was, and I don't think I've got it on the list sitting in front of me here from the looks of it.
That wasn't that long ago, eh?
No, I don't think it was that long ago.
Like 5 or 6 months?
I don't know if it was quite that long.
Well, from the looks of it, it was within now an episode 56, because I've got a episode 56 on a list of all the episodes we did sitting in front of me here. Why I only have up to episode 56 is beyond me, but probably because that's when I printed it out. Yeah. It's pretty crazy to think that we're almost at episode 100. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Pretty bonkers.
Yeah. I'm tempted to retire.
You're gonna have to do some giveaways on 100.
You're tempted to retire.
I'm tempted to retire the show at 100, dude. Call her quits and go on with my life. I don't know.
I'm happy. I love to do doing it the as show. Long as you're doing it, it's your podcast.
It sure as hell eats up a lot of my time. That's for sure, man. And
I just show
time.
I
it's done a lot of good for me, and I know it does a lot of good for the community. There's a lot of people that have really gained from this. A lot of people have messaged me and been like, dude, like I literally learned something new every episode. It's amazing. But there's a part of me that just is like, I don't know, like how much more are we going to be able to help people learn? Like, there's going to be a point where it's just repeated information, and, you know, there are a lot more people that I want to hear their stories, but at the same time, it's just like, yeesh, what do I do here? I don't know. It's maybe tone it down a little bit. And I, if anybody's noticed, I have ran into a little bit of a issue with getting things out on time in the last few episodes. That's for sure. There was like almost a 2 week lap between episodes at one point there, which is terrible. Apologize for that, but such is life. Things are busy. My kid had her birthday and stuff, so I had to focus on family and whatnot, right? And it's the way it is. So
yeah, and I mean, really, it is up to you, man. Like, you put a lot of effort into, you know, setting up these things, and, you know, like actually going and doing the editing and getting the podcast put out, doing the little promo material and stuff. And it's, you know, I think everybody understands that it is a lot of effort for, you know, essentially something that's, you know, we're just doing it for fun. We don't make any money doing this.
I made a few rock climbing videos years ago. I used to do a lot of rock climbing before I had my accident. But I would take like 5 hours footage to make a 15-minute video. It's amazing the amount of editing you have to do to make a finished product and the time that goes into it. Yeah, good on you guys.
I don't know. That's every once in a while, one of these will go out completely unedited.
Happens.
You know, every now and again.
If the episode just happened to be clean enough, why not, right? That doesn't happen too often.
I like how you put it like clean. Like, it's really like we didn't have any, like, you know, technology problems. It's got nothing to do with the content. Usually we just blast that out there no matter what, anyway. Unless somebody's like,
no one's talking about using linseed oil as lube, right? So,
come on, that's like, you know, that's nothing compared to some of the stuff we've said on this show.
Yeah. Well, you weren't there for the last recording. Was Steve jumped in on the last recording with Chris Cash, and we started talking about my episode with the Gatorade bottle back in the day again.
I hope that one got edited.
I think I haven't edited it yet, so I think I'm gonna have to, Might have to edit that out.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, Rachel Bonnet came up because she was in the UK recently for a TV series, hey?
Oh, cool.
She just got back from recording a Hot Wheels show where there's a bunch of people, a bunch of makers, fabricators that work together in teams to create cars of fancy orientation. I don't know what the right word for that is, but the right wording. But fancy cars. And then the competition, whoever won in the long run, ended up having their car actually made into a Hot Wheel car.
Hmm.
And it's a TV series. Pretty nifty. Pretty cool. She's been on a couple TV series now. Cause she was on, what's the one? Is it Rust Bros? The one that's out of BC?
I wouldn't know.
Oh, okay.
I watch very little TV. Yeah.
Yeah, same here, honestly.
What is this TV you speak of? I remember it from back in the day, but I haven't really used one in a long time.
You guys don't do the Netflix and chill thing?
No, I've got no one to chill with. I'm sad and lonely.
It still counts if it's solo, bro. Netflix and chill solo.
I don't think I even like Netflix. Most of the time I just like sit outside smoking a copious amount of cigarettes and watching, you know, like history documentaries.
Pornhub
history documentaries on YouTube. I'm not sitting outside smoking watching Pornhub.
History documentaries on Pornhub. 1970s porn. When the Bush was real.
All right, we want to go controversial here. Straight up, I never even bother going on Pornhub anymore because this whole everything is a like weird stepsister or stepmom thing. It's just too weird
up.
For me.
Too
it's
weird.
Too fucked
yeah.
up, and I'm just like, nope.
You just got to fast forward past the whole like.
Nick, you know they're not really stepbrother and stepsister, right?
Yes, obviously. It's just the fact that that's what they're titling it just weirds me the fuck out. God damn it. What happened to like, you know, pizza delivery boys and plumbers? Come on, guys.
Why you've got strong hands? You must be a blacksmith. Kind of.
No.
Oh dear Lord. The thing that weirds me out the most about that is that shit's like people are following suit, right?
Oh god.
Where are you going with this?
I mean, the whole world's turning into
Saskatchewan. I don't want to know where this is going. Let's stop.
The whole world's turning into Saskatchewan, man.
Moving on. I deeply regret my decision to say, oh yeah, we'll totally do this. How bad could it go? And then I remembered we're talking with Lando.
It's a deep rabbit hole, man. No pun intended.
Is there anybody that you would personally like to be able to spend some time forging with?
Dude, the Victoria Patty question right there, dead or alive?
Pardon?
That's there was a podcast before our time of Forgeside Chat called Blacksmith Her Radio, and Victoria Patty ran that show. She did like 150 episodes, essentially the exact same thing we're doing, but she did it solo and interviewed blacksmiths from around the world, forging relationships with blacksmiths around the world. And one of her questions she asked every episode, name a blacksmith, dead or alive, that you would love to spend a day with. That's essentially what you're asking, right, Nick?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Sure.
That's a really, really difficult question and a great one at the same time. Some of the people that I really look up to, I've had the fortunate opportunity to actually spend time with. But there's also just... the thing is, I don't really put myself into one little hole of what I blacksmith. I consider myself a bit of a general blacksmith, you know, with a little decor work, a little artisan work, axe making, knife making, hammers, tongs, the whole works there. So there's so many people in so many categories that I would love to spend time with and learn from.
No, you have to choose one.
Yeah, I have holy fuck, just pick somebody already.
It's really, you know, I think one of the guys I find really inspiring lately is Thack Ironworks. His armories and his
does some cool
his
shit.
Repose work is just incredible. The stuff he's doing.
Okay, is that what it is? Is repose, not repose?
Maybe it is. Okay, sorry. Yeah, apologies there. Yeah,
well, he's from Quebec almost. So there's that. Maritimes, but, Quebec. He can't say. He can't talk properly. Yeah. That's what's.
But just beautiful, beautiful work that he's putting out. And he's got his little hobbit cave and stuff. So yeah. That would be interesting. Yeah,
he's a character and a half.
Oh, he's a live wire, that one. Yeah. Yeah, he's got energy for days, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very cool, dude.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Howard Clark, I would like to spend some time with. He's down in the States. Master Smith just does some phenomenal, phenomenal stuff.
That wasn't me. That was my dog. No.
Yeah, there's, sure.
Not off the top of my head. I can't really think of too many right off the top of my head. But I've also just had the great experience being able to forge with a lot of the local guys here who are just phenomenal blacksmiths in their own little craft and their niche market that they work in. Yeah.
Yeah, you were mentioning John Little before, and you brought up the phrase that he likes to throw out there with if you learn
want
to
live, less and yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can be you can I'm going to butcher this, but yeah, something along the lines of needing or wanting less and you can live a richer lifestyle, you know. Yeah.
I think he mentioned that on the podcast, actually, in the episode.
I believe
that
he did.
Yeah, was that episode 24 or 48? It was one or the other. Somewhere in there.
I think it was back when
John
I was still
and Nancy are really into
24 then.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, what about you guys? Who would you want to spend a day with?
Oh, wow. Flip it around, eh? Look at that.
Yeah.
Well, I get to go spend a day with John. I get to spend a day with Justin Lamoureux right away.
Nice.
I'm going to go take a course with him and do a chef knife out of 1084, which I'm super excited about because everyone's bugging me that I should be making knives and blah, 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 blah. You're a bladesmith. Well, if I'm going to be a bladesmith, I might as well be a proper bladesmith and actually know what the fuck I'm doing.
You do realize I'm just hassling you, right?
I have a hard time handling that shit. What can I say, man? People fucking gets in my head, dude. I can't handle it. What can I say? Yeah. It's who I am. Thanks a lot, you fucker.
Deal with it, yo.
I am. I'm going to go take a bladesmithing course. So, nice. But if I had to pick somebody, there's lots of people, dude. That's a really tough question. North
America. You asked me the same question. Yeah. You gave me shit when I said it was a tough one.
North America. If I had to pick somebody in North America, I want to go to the Center for Metal Arts and work with
Nick Rossi,
Pat Quinn, and it would be so awesome to get a crew like, with Jake James there. Pat Quinn and Jake James at Center for Metal Art. Oh, dude, that would. Whoa, I think I just what's that happening to me? Shivering. Sorry. Weird feelings there. But yeah, if there's guys like in Europe that holy fuck that I would love. What's the guy from Russia? SBK, I think SB Kuznick or something like that. Kuznick, I don't know. He's good fucking stuff, dude, out of Russia.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah, and Ukraine, there's a guy out of the Ukraine that I've been following too that does really good stuff. I don't know. Like I said, Center for Metal of Arts and a crew of people would be a dream come true for me. Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to go and check out Center for Metal Arts.
Nice.
I think the other one, there's a guy named Tord who runs Thor's Forge. He does historical reproductions of stuff like Dane axes. Restacked wrought iron and homemade bloomery steel. Just like full authentic reproductions of those things. I would just fucking love to go and do that. Whole process with them. That would be wicked. The stuff he produces is just outstanding.
Oh, dude. I'm such an idiot.
The problem is I can't find his last bloody name. I can't remember it.
Oh. I thought I was an idiot, but that doesn't help. Pep is the guy that I would want to go spend a day with. Pep Gomez. We interviewed him just a couple episodes ago. Dude, that guy's been on my radar for years now. I would love to spend a fucking day with that dude so much.
Where's he based out of?
New Mexico.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's okay. Go spend a day with him during the Baja season and possibly get to go ride in a Baja vehicle. Holy fuck, buddy.
Ulterior motives.
Fuck. Well, blacksmith for the morning or Baja in the morning and blacksmith in the evening. And, oh, buddy, that'd be good times.
You know who's really fun to forge with? Rick Marchand. That guy is a hoot. Man, every time I'm with him, I'm just in laughs the whole time. That guy has just got such a presence. He's great at explaining things. He's fun. He's a fun guy to forge. Anybody who's looking into taking a course for knife making, they should look into reaching out to Rick. He does some awesome stuff.
That's funny you say that. Not really funny, but awesome that you say that. And you're so freaking right, dude. If I get to a point where I'm going to gonna be serious about this, I'm totally going to go. He's got a freaking place for guests to stay at his shop.
He's got a B&B there, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's the perfect setup. In Lunenburg, it's not, like, you can't pick a more beautiful location. That's amazing, dude.
I think he's in Mahone Bay, isn't he?
I have him listed as Lunenburg, I'm pretty sure, okay. But I don't know.
Lunenburg County, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know why Nova Scotia geography that well.
Yeah. Here, I am in Manitoba. I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
That's
right?
Fair. Yeah.
Casey Valinsky would be another cool guy to go learn how to do some knife working from. He's a fucking rad dude. Yako. Dude. Yako van Bruenhorst. Fuck, I'd love to spend a day with that guy.
Yeah,
I was supposed to spend a whole week with him.
That'd be like being plugged into the Matrix.
Yeah. He's close to you. Why don't you go hang out with him?
I don't know him that well.
Just show up. He likes people.
I'm weird, though.
He likes weird people. He likes me. That says a lot, dude.
That does say it does say a lot.
I mean, he used to like me. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't anymore. I actually just reached out to him recently and was like, dude, I need to get a stack of your stickers because I'm trying to set up a thing where I can send out a thank you to all of our previous guests.
That'd be cool.
After episode 100, it's all going to be memorabilia. So,
is it really going to finish at 100?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm really not.
Lando's not sure. Don't make him commit to anything.
I don't know about anything. I don't make plans, dude, because there's just no point. Everything changes all the time so much. I've mediocre plans here and there, and I could say I'm gonna stop at 100, but I don't want to. I want to keep going, but pressure's on.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's this Pete LePay guy I'd like to try forging with him. He's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Got a big shop, got a big yard, pitch a tent, come on down. Shop's always open.
Well, you never know. I may, in fact, take you up on that.
Yeah, there's been a lot of people who have. Come on down, man. Yeah, I'm always happy to have people by.
Did you hook up with Samuel? Not Samuel Lazard. Oh, shoot. Guy in Quebec. Knife maker. Did you guys hook up recently?
No, it wasn't me.
Yellen.
No.
No? Samuel no. Yellen? No. Okay.
Yeah.
I know there's Noah Vachon. Did you guys hook up?
No, no one out of province other than Nick in the last year. Yeah.
Yeah, Noah's Vachon, but I've got a few... and the other guys that hooked up then at their shop. I'm sorry.
Okay. I got a few guys in the works coming up that I'll probably be spending a day or two with here that I'm looking forward to. But yeah, but most of the time it's just local makers. There's a little group of us who, you know, we generally get together once a year, whether it be as a group or individually. But it's always nice to get together with other makers. And you know, most of us all forge knives, but we end up spending time forging little trinkety things or just, you know, goofing around, having fun, learning from each other. And that's the great thing about it. You know, everyone's got different techniques and designs and styles. And yeah, wow. You bring those collaborative efforts and ideas together and you can inspire yourself to just sort of branch out and try something out of your realm. So, yeah.
I know I love getting together with people and branching out the artistic venues and seeing what everybody has to offer and kind of playing with that.
Yeah.
Good times. I'm hoping there's a hammer in this weekend that I'm going to head to, but it's more like a Farriers event.
So right.
See how that goes. But DK Smalls are small.
Oh,
I always call him Smalls, but DK Smalls is going to be at the event.
So, oh, that's awesome. He's great.
I haven't seen him for a couple of years now, so I'm looking forward to seeing him. That'll be great.
Nice. I still need to do one of those wrought iron hammers.
Yeah, no kidding, dude. Yeah. By hand, right?
Yes, right. Completely by hand.
Yeah.
No fucking around.
Yeah, those wrought iron hammers, they're gorgeous. Yeah, it's like the Damascus of hammer making, right?
Well, you can make Damascus hammers.
There's a few guys.
Yeah, you can, but it doesn't have the same effect as an old wrought iron wagon wheel stacked up and forge welded.
Yeah, it's hipster and, Damascus.
I think there's something classy about it.
No, it definitely is. He does just a brilliant job of them.
Yeah, he does.
I absolutely cherish the one that I've got. It's not going to get used. I'm sorry.
Oh, no?
No. I can't bring myself to use it. It's just too nice.
Yeah.
Keep that thing nice and polished and not a scuff on the face. I want to be able to keep a mirror finish on it so I can look at myself and see how not pretty I am.
Yeah, just make sure you look at the round side. So it's all...
It helps.
It can't hurt.
Music. Yeah. What have you guys been listening to in the shop lately?
Ooh, good one. My go-to is Nathaniel Ratcliffe.
Nice.
I crank that up. I love forge into that. It's just got good rhythm, good beat. You can just keep swinging to it the whole day.
Yeah,
that's one of my go-tos for sure.
Specific song in general, or
no, not really.
Can you give me one that I can add to the list?
Oh, geez. Never Grow Old is a good one.
That's one of my favorites, yeah. Never Grow Old or SOB.
Yeah. Yeah, SOB's kind of, it got too
overplayed,
too mainstream for me. I think it kind of ruined it a little bit, but he's got a new album out. I've listened to a couple times here. Just, I don't know the names of the songs on it, but always a good upbeat there. Sublime is also a really great one.
Nice.
I love putting on the old Sublime. Yeah.
Right on.
I've been jamming out some Sublime recently too. That's awesome, dude.
Nice. Yeah, that's my summer tunes for sure.
Nice, for sure. Definitely summer tunes right there.
Yeah.
Lando, what about you boys?
Off the top of my head, not really. that I can think of real quick here. I'm going to have to think about it a little bit. Sublime would be a good choice because I have been listening to Sublime a little bit. But go ahead, Nick.
It just irritates the crap out of me. You're like, make sure you've got one. You don't have one yourself. Come on.
Well, I don't know, man. I don't know. It's, what can I say? I'm terrible for that.
Yes. Yes, you are. I had an old favorite of mine that just kind of popped into my head, and I was listening to it in my shop the other day. It was Toxicity by System of a Down.
Oh, yeah.
Right on.
That one. It was the most conventional song I've ever picked, I think.
I think I'm going to go with a Sublime song, dude. I just have to...
Oh, come on. Just pick the one that everybody knows.
I recently... Sublime, no, full album. Shoot, I just listened. I just searched full album. Shoot.
Make sure some brilliant podcast material, Andy.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks,
buddy. Giving me crap for doing this earlier. Guess it was actually something relevant.
Guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to have to edit the shit out of this. I don't know. Bad Fish. Sublime Bad Fish.
There you go.
Yeah, that's a good one.
What was yours again, Nick?
Toxicity by System of a Down.
You've done, no, you didn't do System of a Down, and it wasn't Toxicity. Well, she did System of a Down.
Oh, did he?
He did a...
Like Chop Suey? Aerials?
I think it was Chop Suey. No.
Another solid song.
Anyways, yeah. I'm not a huge fan of System of a Down anymore. I was a huge fan of them when I was like younger, when they first came out type thing onto the scene. But I don't know, man. It's just not my jam anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely like occasion specific. Like, I'm not going to listen to System all the time. But there are some times where I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah.
That's Pantera for me, buddy. Every once in a while, I got to throw in some Phil and... Actually, Bill McClintock just did a mix mashup with Pantera and the guys that did the song Tequila.
Good lord.
Fuck yeah!
Oh, it's cursed. It's cursed.
That was gonna be my song choice, but I think I've done a Bill McClintock song before, so I kind of like was like, ah, I can't do it again. But yeah, Fakila. That's a great song. Fakila, it's great, dude.
I know, you literally make the rules. If you want to put it on there, you can put it on there.
Yeah, well, my rule with myself was that I wasn't too sure if I wanted to double down on the same artist. I don't know. I try to stay eclectic.
Well, you're certainly not beating me for eclectic.
Well, no, not when you're fucking putting in circus songs.
Classical music.
I had
random
fucking,
weird shit.
What was her name? Elaine? I had the song by her. That's like a fucking 1960s tune, dude. Hmm. I've got some old shit. Yeah, fuck. So shut the fuck up. Let's wrap this bitch up.
I am the one who was sitting there putting like Verdi operas in there on the list.
You're definitely not going to get any opera from me. That's for sure. Sorry there.
Come on, the Anvil's
Ever
chorus.
Just put on CBC Radio and go to it?
Dude, one of my last ones was La Tigre, Decepticon. And guess where I heard that? University Radio. How many fucking people are listening to University Radio? I'll tell you what.
Yeah, nobody.
Weirdos. Weirdos like me. Anyways.
All right, we got to throw a sheepskin on this.
Yeah, let's do this. Coo, look, coo, 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 coo.
Good day.
I gotcha. Good day. This was a fun episode.
This was a fun episode. This was a really good chat, man.
Yeah, it was nice to sit down with you guys. Yeah, thanks, man. You guys as well. Yeah, it's so weird because with social media, you get to meet so many people from across the country, and you see their work, and you don't really talk to them directly, but getting some FaceTime here and meeting a bit more one-on-one, it's nice to put a face and a personality to the work, you know?
Yeah, I agree, great. Dude.
Yeah, it's nice to meet people and who share the love of the craft, for sure.
And you also happen to be giant fucking goofballs.
Well, you guys keep clucking like chickens at the end of the show.
It's Karukaku. Kuru.
So what's the history on, like, I know we spoke briefly before the show there, but it's so
this is
Karukaku. Like, what's Bob and Doug?
They were SCTV comedians, and they got pulled aside by the producer and said, we don't have enough Canadian content. Real quick, we need you guys to come up with something to add 2 minutes of Canadian content to the end of our show. You guys could do whatever you want, improvise, but it has to be Canadian content. So Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas at the end of the show sat down and started doing an improvised skit on Canadian bullshit. And they coined the term hoser.
Canadian bullshit is probably the way to put it.
they coined the term hoser. They coined the whole Karukaku thing out of who know. I don't know where they came up with this shit, man, dude. Like, if there's any pretext to them getting into doing it, or how they pulled that out of their ass, is beyond me, dude. It's good shit. And then they did a movie, Strange Brew.
Strange Brew.
So they're like the Canadian version of Bill and Ted, eh?
But like way before Bill and Ted, and Bill and Ted were like kind of like teenagers. These guys are like in their late 20s, early 30s, maybe at that point.
Okay.
And definitely, like, they love their beer, love their smokes. And not as like rad as Bill and Ted. They weren't like surfers. Okay. Yeah, they were, you know, they're hosers.
They were the beer and darts kind of. Okay.
Drink too much beer, and that's all that matters is drinking their beer.
Yeah. Sweet.
And Strange Brew is something. The movie is something about a brewery that has some strange activity going on that they must investigate. Did you know that they
have seen it? You should watch it.
I've never seen that. I've never heard of it, to be honest. Oh,
Canadian classic. Did you know they figured out the trick that if you want a free case of beer, that all you have to do is take an empty beer bottle, get a baby mouse, put it inside the beer bottle because a baby mouse will fit in the bottle, right? And then you feed it until it becomes a big mouse, and then, like, you fill it full of beer and take it back in and say, hey, there was a mouse in my beer, and you get a free case of beer.
Sounds like an awful lot of work for a case of beer.
It's a free case of beer. I don't know. I think as I'm describing that, I'm like, holy crap. The what's that? PETA? They would be all over that.
They would be. It reminds me of the Trailer Park Boys. They had an episode where they wanted to go see a Rush concert, so they found the sewer passage where they could go under the city and travel all the way into the Halifax Metro Center and pop up through the sewer grate so they could go see Rush without buying the tickets.
Yep. Trailer Park Boys and Bill and. Yeah, or Bob and Doug would definitely fit together decently.
Well, live in the same realm. We should add more, like, oddball CanCon stuff to this. Like, you know, House Hippo references and, you know, every once in a while just burst out into singing the log.
Dr. Penfield, I smell burnt toast.
Oh, I smell burnt toast.
What?
I'm What's sure that he means the houses, the village.
He said House Hippo references. It was the whole I can put my arm back on, you can't kind of thing.
Oh, no, that was, what was that?
Play safe.
Yeah, that was a War Amps thing, wasn't it?
That's what, it wasn't a Canadian history one, that's right.
Yeah. No, the House Hippos was Concerned Children's Advertisers, who also did the Don't You Put It In Your Mouth weird.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that one. Yeah. Don't you stuff it in your face. Yeah. It might look good to eat. That, like, that was a creepy song. And those puppets are creepy, too.
Yes, they were really creepy. There's that. Like I said, the log driver's waltz. Like, I still, I know the entirety of that song. Awesome. It's like the ultimate in Canadiana.
Did you guys get... I'm basing off of, how old are you again?
I'm in my 40s, early 40s.
Yeah, okay, so we're about the same age. So did you get anti-drug paraphernalia handed out to you in, like, elementary school?
No.
Okay, in grade, no. I remember specifically it was grade 3. The police and the fire department came to our school during this, like, thing or whatever where it was anti-drug week, and they had, you know, they talked to the kids, and there's some paraphernalia that they handed out, and one of the pamphlets that they handed out was like space characters or something like that that were like selling drugs, and it was like teaching you like how bad drugs are, but at the meantime it's like, this looks so cool, I like, I kind of want to do drugs now.
So here, before we go, I'll tell you a quick story about the high school I grew up in. On the soccer field, magic mushrooms used to grow.
Oh, God.
So all the stoners would go at lunchtime, would go in the cafeteria, buy a bag of chips. They'd walk out back of the school, dump the chips out on the ground, and then walk over to the soccer field and fill the bag with magic mushrooms. And then they go to class in the afternoon eating the magic mushrooms out of the chip bag.
Oh, man. And nothing was learned.
What a wild ride that'd be, eh?
Yeah, I think they should have learned to dry them first, but I'll leave it to them.
I hear they still have effect if they're not dried, but
yeah. I'm not entirely sure, but I think the potency needs, it isn't quite there unless they're right. dried. I'm not
that's what, that's
outside
what
my wheelhouse, man.
I also, if I'm not mistaken, you can actually get very sick from them if they're not dried. I could be wrong.
Yeah, or if you pick the wrong one, yeah.
Well, there's definitely that.
Yes, public service announcement, don't you put it in your mouth.
All right. I need those peach baskets back.
I need the peach baskets. Oh, there were so many of those.
Yeah.
Time to go light the forge, boys. We'll catch you later.
All right. Night, guys.
Thanks, Pete.
Thank you.